not because he possesses the gift of oratory and can preach eloquent sermons, but because he expresses divine powers through his words and deeds. A thoroughly illiterate man can attain to the highest state of spiritual perfection without going to any school or university, and without reading any scripture, if he can conquer his animal nature by realizing his true self and its relation to the universal spirit, or, in other words, if he can attain to the knowledge of that truth which dwells within him, and which is the same as the infinite source of existence, intelligence, and bliss. He who has mastered all the scriptures, philosophies, and sciences, may be regarded by society as an intellectual giant, yet he cannot be equal to that unlettered man who, having realized the eternal truth, has become one with it, who sees God everywhere, and who lives on this earth as an embodiment of divinity. The writer had the good fortune to be acquainted with such a divine man in India. His name was Ramakrishna. He never went to any school, neither had he read any of the scriptures, philosophies, or scientific treatises of the world, yet he had reached perfection by realizing God through the practice of yoga. Hundreds of men and women came to see him and were spiritually awakened and uplifted by the divine powers which this illiterate man possessed. Today he is revered and worshipped by thousands all over India as is Jesus the Christ in Christendom. He could expound with extraordinary clearness the subtlest problems of philosophy or of science, and answer the most intricate questions of clever theologians in such a masterly way as to dispel all doubts concerning the matter in hand. How could he do this without reading books? By his wonderful insight into the true nature of things, and by that yoga power which made him directly perceive things which cannot be revealed by the senses. His spiritual eyes were open, his sight could penetrate through the thick veil of ignorance that hangs before the vision of ordinary mortals, and which prevents them from knowing that which exists beyond the range of sense perception. These powers begin to manifest in the soul that is awakened to the ultimate reality of the universe. It is then that the sixth sense of direct perception of higher truths develops and frees it from dependence upon the sense powers. This sixth sense or spiritual eye is latent in each individual, but it opens in a few only among millions, and they are known all as yogis. With the vast majority it is in a rudimentary state, covered by a thick veil. When, however, through the practice of yoga it unfolds in a man, he becomes conscious of the higher invisible realms and of everything that exists on the soul plane. Whatever he says harmonizes with the sayings and writings of all the great seers of truth of every age and clime. He does not study books, he has no need to do so, for he knows all that the human intellect can conceive. He can grasp the purport of a book without reading its text. He also understands how much the human mind can express through words, and he is familiar with it which is beyond thoughts and which consequently can never be expressed by words. Before arriving at such spiritual illumination he goes through diverse stages of mental and spiritual evolution, and in consequence knows all that can be experienced by a human intellect. He does not, however, care to remain confined within the limit of sense perception, and is not contented with the intellectual apprehension of relative reality, but his sole aim is to enter into the realm of the absolute, which is the beginning and end of phenomenal objects and of relative knowledge. Thus striving for the realization of the highest, he does not fail to collect all relative knowledge pertaining to the world of phenomena that comes in his way, as he marches on toward his destination, the unfoldment of his true self. Our true self is all, knowing by its nature. It is the source of infinite knowledge within us. Being bound by the limitations of time, space, and causation, we cannot express all the powers that we possess in reality. The higher we rise above these limiting conditions, the more we can manifest the divine qualities of omniscience and omnipotence. If, on the contrary, we keep our minds fixed upon phenomena and devote the whole of our energy to acquiring knowledge dependent entirely upon sense perceptions, shall we ever reach the end of phenomenal knowledge? Shall we ever be able to know the real nature of the things of this universe? No. Because the senses cannot lead us beyond the superficial appearance of sense objects. In order to go deeper in the realm of the invisible, we invent instruments, and with their help we are able to penetrate a little further, but these instruments, again, have their limit. After using one kind of instrument, we become dissatisfied with the results and search for some other which may reveal more and more, and thus we struggle on, discovering at each step how poor and helpless are the sense powers in the path of the knowledge of the Absolute. At last we are driven to the conclusion that any instrument, no matter how fine, can never help us to realize that which is beyond the reach of sense, perception, intellect, and thought. So, even if we could spend the whole of our time and energy in studying phenomena, we shall never arrive at any satisfactory result or be able to see things as they are in reality. The knowledge of today, gained by the help of certain instruments, will be the ignorance of tomorrow, if we get better instruments. The knowledge of last year is already the ignorance of the present year. The knowledge of this century will be ignorance in the light of the discoveries of a new century. The span of one human life is, therefore, too short to even attempt to acquire a correct knowledge of all things existing on the phenomenal plane. The life, time of hundreds of thousands of generations, nay, of all humanity, seems too short, when we consider the infinite variety to be found in the universe, and the countless number of objects that will have to be known before we can reach the end of knowledge. If a man could live a million years, keeping his senses in perfect order during that long period, and could spend every moment in studying nature and in diligently endeavoring to learn every minute detail of phenomenal objects, would his search after knowledge be fulfilled at the expiration of that time? Certainly not. He would want still more time, a finer power of perception, a keener intellect, a subtler understanding, and then he might say, as did Sir Isaac Newton after a life of tireless research, I have collected only pebbles on the shore of the ocean of knowledge. If a genius like Newton could not even reach the edge of the water of that ocean, how can we expect to cross the vast expanse from shore to shore in a few brief years? Thousands of generations have passed away, thousands will pass, yet must the knowledge regarding the phenomena of the universe remain imperfect. Veil after veil may be removed, but veil after veil will remain behind. This was understood by the yogis and seers of truth in India, who said, innumerable are the branches of knowledge, but short is our time and many are the obstacles in the way, therefore wise men should first struggle to know that which is highest. Here the question arises, which is the highest knowledge? This question is as old as history. It has puzzled the minds of the philosophers, scientists, and scholars of all ages and all countries. Some have found an answer to it, others have not. The same question was voiced in ancient times by Socrates, when he went to the Delphic Oracle and asked, of all knowledge which is the highest? To which came the answer, know thyself. We read in one of the Upanishads that a great thinker, after studying all the philosophies and sciences known at that time, came to a seer of truth and said, Sir, I am tired of this lower knowledge that can be gained from books or through the study of the world of phenomena, it no longer satisfies me, for science cannot reveal the ultimate truth, I wish to know that which is the highest. Is there anything by knowing which I can know the reality of the universe? The sage replied, Yes, there is, and that knowledge is the highest, by knowing which you can know the true nature of everything in the universe. And he continued, Know thyself. If thou canst learn the true nature of thine own self, thou wilt know the reality of the universe. In thy true self thou wilt find the eternal truth, the infinite source of all phenomena. By knowing this thou wilt know God and his whole creation. As by knowing the chemical properties of one drop of water, we know the properties of all water wherever it appears, so by knowing who and what we are in reality, we shall realize the final truth. Man is the epitome of the universe. That which exists in the macrocosm is to be found in the microcosm. Therefore the knowledge of one's true self is the highest of all knowledge. Our real self is divine and one with God. This may seem to us at present a mere theory, but the nearer we approach the ultimate truth, the more clearly shall we understand that it is not a theory but a fact, that now we are dreaming in the sleep of ignorance and fancying ourselves this or that particular person. But as all experience gained in dreams afterwards appears of little consequence, so, waking up from this sleep, we shall find that the knowledge of phenomenal nature, upon which we place so much value at present, is of little importance. We shall then realize that all research in the various branches of science depends upon self-knowledge, and that self-knowledge is the foundation upon which the structure of phenomenal knowledge is built. Knowledge of the self or Atman is therefore the highest of all. It is the ideal of the science of yoga, and should be the aim of our life. We should hold it as our first duty to acquire this self-knowledge before we try to know anything concerning the objects of sense, perception. How can we gain it? Not from books, not through the study of external phenomena, but by studying our own nature, and by practicing the different branches of yoga. How to Be a Yogi, by Swami Abhedananda, 1902. Almost last in the book is this to be extracted. Toward the morning of life, the Lord is present with every human being, urgent and instant to be received, and when a man receives him, as he does when he acknowledges him as his God, Creator, Redeemer and Savior, then is his first coming, which is called the dawn. From this time the man begins to be enlightened, as to understanding in things spiritual, and to advance into a more and more interior wisdom. As he receives this wisdom from the Lord, so he advances through morning into day, and this day lasts with him into old age, even to death, and after death he passes into heaven to the Lord himself, and there, though he died an old man, he is restored to the morning of his life, and to eternity he develops the beginnings of the wisdom that was implanted in the natural world. The people of heaven are continually advancing towards the spring, time of life, and the more thousands of years they live, the more delightful and happy is the spring to which they attain. Women who have died old and worn out with age, and have lived in faith in the Lord and in charity to the neighbor, come, with the succession of years, more and more into the flower of youth and early womanhood, and into a beauty exceeding every idea of beauty ever formed through the sight. In a word, to grow old in heaven is to grow young. Evil is hell. Evil with man is hell with him, for it is the same thing whether we say evil or hell. And as a man is the cause of his own evil, therefore he, and not the Lord, also leads himself into hell. So far is the Lord from leading man into hell, that he delivers him from it as far as a man does not will and love to be in his own evil, all a man's will and love remains with him after death. He who wills and loves evil in the world, wills and loves the same evil in the other life, and then he no longer suffers himself to be withdrawn from it. This is the reason that a man who is in evil is bound fast to hell and is actually there, too, in spirit, and after death he desires nothing more than to be where his evil is. After death, therefore, a man casts himself into hell, and not the Lord. Evil and punishment. All evil bears its punishment with it. Evil spirits are punished because the fear of punishment is the one means of subduing evils in this state. Exhortation no longer avails, nor instruction, nor fear of the law, nor fear for one's reputation, for now the spirit acts from a nature which cannot be coerced or broken except by punishment. From Heaven and Hell. And more from that book follows. Master passions of hell. Love of self and love of the world rule in the hells and also constitute them. Love to the Lord and love toward the neighbor rule in the heavens and also constitute them. These loves are diametrically opposite. Love of self consists in wishing well to oneself alone, and not to others except for the sake of oneself, not even to the church, to one's country, or to any human society, also in doing good to them, but for the sake of one's reputation, honor and glory. Unless he sees these in the service as he renders them, he says in his heart, of what use is it? Why should I do it? Of what advantage will it be to me? And he leaves it undone. His delight is only that of self, love. And because the delight which springs from his love makes the life of man, therefore his life is the life of self, and the life of self is life from man's proprium, and the proprium of man, viewed in itself, is nothing but evil. Love of self is of such a quality, too, that, as far as the reins are given it, it rushes on until at length it desires to rule not only over the whole earth, but over the whole heaven, too, and over the divine himself. Our name is Legion. Men have believed hitherto that there is some one devil who is over the hells, and that he was created an angel of light, but that after he turned rebel, he was cast down with his crew into hell. Men have had this belief because the devil is named in the word, and Satan, and also Lucifer, and in these passages the word has been understood according to the sense of the letter, when yet hell is meant in them by the devil and Satan. That there is no single devil to whom the hells are subject, is also evident from this fact, that all who are in the hells, like all who are in the heavens, are from the human race, and that from the beginning of the creation to this time they amount to myriads of myriads, every one of whom is a devil of a sort according with his opposition to the divine in the world. Communication with the spiritual world. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. One's spiritual company. The mind of a man is his spirit which lives after death, and a man's spirit is constantly in company with spirits like himself in the spiritual world. Man does not know that in respect to his mind he is in the midst of spirits because the spirits with whom he is in company in that world, think and speak spiritually. The spirit of man, however, while in the material body, thinks and speaks naturally, and spiritual thought and speech cannot be understood, nor perceived, by the natural human being, nor the reverse. Hence, too, it is that spirits cannot be seen. Yet when a man's spirit is in society with spirits in their world, then he is in spiritual thought and speech with them, too, because his inner mind is spiritual, but the outer natural, wherefore by his inner nature he communicates with them, and by his outer being with men. By this communication a man perceives and thinks analytically. If there were no such communication, men would no more think than a beast, nor any differently from a beast. Indeed, were all commerce with spirits cut off, a man would instantly die. Ministers of his, that do his pleasure. Man is quite ignorant that he is governed by the Lord through angels and spirits, and that there are at least two spirits with a man and two angels. Through the spirits a communication of the man with the world of spirits is effected, and through the angels, with heaven. As long as a man is not regenerated, he is governed quite otherwise than when he is regenerated. While unregenerated, there are evil spirits with him, who dominate him so fully that the angels, though present, can scarcely do more than guide him, so that he shall not hurl himself into the lowest evil, and bend him to some good by means of his own desires, indeed, and to some truth through even fallacies of sense. Then, through the spirits who are with him, he has communication with the world of spirits, but not so much with heaven, for the evil spirits rule with him, and the angels only avert their rule. When, however, a man is regenerated, then the angels rule and inspire in him all good and truth, and a horror and dread of evil and falsity. The angels lead the man indeed, but serve only as ministers, for it is the Lord alone, who, by angels and spirits, governs man. It is an office of the angels to inspire charity and faith in a man, to observe the direction his enjoyments take, and to restrain and bend them to good, as far as they can in man's free choice. They are forbidden to act violently, and so to break a man's cupidities and principles, but are bidden to act gently. It is also an office of theirs to govern evil spirits who are from hell. When evil spirits infuse evils and what is false, the angels instill what is true and good, by which they at least temper an evil. Infernal spirits are continually assaulting, and angels constantly giving protection. Especially do the angels call forth goods and truths which are with a man, and oppose them to the evils and falsities which the evil spirits excite. Hence a man is in their midst, nor does he oppose, save the evil or the good, and being in the midst, is free to turn himself to the one or to the other. By such means angels from the Lord lead and protect a man, and this every moment, and every moment of a moment. For, should the angels intermit their care a single instant, men would be plunged into it. Thence it is that the Spirit speaking is in the same principles as the man, whether these be true or false. These he stirs up, and through his affection, united to the man's, strongly confirms them. All this shows the danger in which a man is who speaks with spirits, or who manifestly perceives their operation. Of the nature of his affection, good or bad, a man is ignorant, also with what others he is associated. If his is a pride of self, intelligence, the Spirit favors every thought from that source. Likewise there is the favoring of principles which are inflamed from the fire which those have who are not in truths from any genuine affection for them. Whenever from a like affection a spirit favors a man's thoughts or principles, then the former leads the last separated in the death of one of them. For the spirit of the deceased partner lives continually with the spirit of the other, not yet deceased, and this even to the death of the other, when they meet again and reunite, and love each other more tenderly than before. For now they are in the spiritual world. About author, Marilyn Hughes. Forgotten Mystics in World Religions, Lesser Known Out of Body Experiences presents a fascinating path in the study of mysticism and out of body travel. In my studies, I have found that there are a great deal of forgotten mystics and thus, out of body experiences, in many religious traditions whose work was powerful, meaningful, vibrant and eternal. It seems unfortunate and definitely at odds with the will of the God that such works be lost in our time when such great effort was made during theirs to bring their individual out of body travel revelations to light. So we've decided to feature forgotten mystics and out of body travelers, some of whom are less forgotten than others, but all of whom have fallen out of the public limelight despite the fantastic and profound messages they were sent to receive and give to the rest of us throughout, of, body experiences. Having worked primarily in radio broadcasting, Marilyn Hughes spent several